And now we'll hear from our final speaker of the afternoon, which is the Montreal Stars general manager, Meg Hewings. She's a big hockey fan and also plays hockey. She began her hockey career at the age of 11 as a Leaside Angel, later played varsity hockey for the McGill Martlets right here at McGill University, and one season in the women's semi-pro circuit with the Montreal Wingstar. She remains active in the sport, as I mentioned, as general manager of the local women's hockey team, the Montreal Stars, a professional team that now have a new, recently, partnership with the Montreal Canadiens. And she's also a founder of the Lovely Hockey League. She also works in media arts in Montreal, exploring where art, sport, and culture mingle. So, and she will present today, Woman in Hockey, A Question of Belonging. Please welcome Ms. Meg Hewings.
I feel like we might need a body break, huh? We're like... I'm not someone who does kind of formal podium stadium stuff, so can I move around with this microphone? Or?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Good. Yeah, it's better for me to move a little bit. I do not have a beard and I cannot grow one, but I've always been very interested in hockey and questions of belonging. That's why I have called the presentation Invisibility, but I thought I might just start... with questions for you guys, because I like to know what people know about hockey and what they think about it. How many people saw the gold medal games in either Salt Lake City or Sochi or Vancouver, the women's games? Okay, great. And how many people play hockey? A few here and there. How many people wanted to play hockey but couldn't for whatever reason? One, two, three, four, a few. How many people couldn't care less about hockey? Awesome. I like to know where they are. So I like to ask those questions because I'm very interested in the ways in which hockey, you know, has been kind of coined a national sport, but also the ways in which it isn't easily penetrated, let's say. It's not an easy sport to play. It's expensive. It's inaccessible. And it's intimidating, frankly, I mean, to step on the ice sometimes if you have never done so. So all of those things have been a personal interest to me and kind of began when I was a very young child and saw guys playing. I was, of course, stuck in figure skates and wondering what I was doing in female drag, you know, with lots of lipstick and trying to fit in very badly. And I saw hockey and I said to myself, that's the game I want to play. This is a kind of form of expression that looks super interesting and I can't wait to get on the ice. So that's how it began for me. I don't know how many people know that the first organized women's hockey game actually took place right outside the window here on the McGill campus in 1894. I believe it was the women of the Royal Victoria College who are pictured here on the photo. This is a little bit later, actually, the photo. But they requested of the president of the college to actually participate. And hockey had been kind of gaining a lot of ground, and people were excited about it, certainly in the Anglo-Protestant and very elite upper classes for men. And so the women wanted to try it. And they asked if they could, and basically the response was, here are the three conditions. You have to dress warmly. You'll be supervised by three male guardians. And actually, one was positioned on the roof of the Phys Ed building at the time. Two were down by Sherbrooke. And no men were allowed to watch the game. So there were no spectators allowed. So that was the very first organized women's game. Very early in the history of the sport, in the 1800s, women were pictured here in the first ever book about hockey that was printed. These are women from Westmount playing. As I mentioned, the sport was largely played by Anglo-Saxon upper-class women from the beginning, and still to this day it tends to be played by people who can afford to play it. And these women were in their outfits and their skirts, happily. These were two of the stars of the early days of women's hockey, Albertine Lapensee and Agnès Vautier. There were Francophone women that played, often at the, in the beginning days of hockey. For Francophone women, it was harder to get into the sport. It was the same for men, actually, because of the Catholic disdain, I guess, for playing. She managed to break through and was an incredibly successful and probably one of the first stars of the game. She used to attract upward of 3,000 and 10,000 people to some of the games that were being played. So I think it's sort of interesting just to do a quick survey of the history of the game, because for many people, I think they think that women have always been spectators in the sport, and they truly have been active players in the sport and changed the face of the game since the beginning. Early on, contests that were featuring women did very well here in Montreal, so there are examples. And in fact, women played in pretty much all of the same houses as their male counterparts, including the semi-professional and amateur sports. So the Jubilee, where else was it? Mount Royal Arena, the Forum. So women were regularly playing in those places. Miss Hardman was actually the first to wear, she was a goalie, and she had to face one of the hardest slap shots from one of the defenders in her league, and she was one of the first to wear a face mask. So long before Jack Plante, there are cases where women were making history and they were actually innovating in the sport, and often their stories, I guess, were left to the wayside. There are even women who, like their brothers, were playing for the Montreal Maroons in this case. These are the Ward siblings, Isabel. And the same was the case for Dickie Moore. His sister played. These are the McGill women. Throughout history, McGill has played a very important role in women's hockey. And even, I work now for the Canadian Women's Hockey League, but there was a former edition of the league called the Ligue Féminine de Hockey des Canadiennes. Puis c'était ça, leurs équipes, La Majesté, La Marquise, Princesse et Souveraine. So in the 60s, we had the first beginnings of women's pro leagues, and that was their schedule. She kind of looks like she's wearing figure skates, but anyway. There was even a female hockey team called Les Canadiennes. They were largely Anglophones, I believe, and they played against, they were the Francophone team. So you always saw instances also of women wearing and participating, like the Maroons, with their male counterparts and a goalie. This, in this case, the logo was Les Canadiennes, Ladies Canadiennes, so they usurped that. So, you know, fast forward 100 years, I went to go play at McGill in 1996, and there was no recruiting at the time. The team was pretty underfunded. We sold chocolate almonds to fundraise for our operations needs. And our locker room was actually on the opposite side from the men's locker room. And it's since been redesigned and renovated entirely so that both facilities could be placed side by side now and share some of the same facilities, such as a weight room, coaches' rooms, and therapy rooms. But at the time, we were in the beer league locker room on the other side. So that's sort of the atmosphere that I entered into. And it was surprising to me. You know, I was a budding feminist. I was taking gender studies classes. And for me, I got to McGill, which was supposedly the hotbed of women's hockey. It had this rich history. And yet, somehow in 1996, which, you know, isn't that long ago, the program was woefully underfunded. So I think that's where I kind of began to ask a number of the questions that kind of I've continued to ask over the past 20 years or more now. My goodness, getting old. So in general, these were the major questions that were asked of me in 1996. I don't think it's too different. I think it's changing now. But basically, when people would say, you know, oh, you know, you play hockey, field hockey, I say, no, you know, on the ice, with the skates, the whole thing. Often questions about, you know, who and who isn't on your team. So, you know, early on, questions related to sexism and homophobia were very much a part of, I think, always making women have to defend the fact that they're playing and to legitimize our sport. The other one, of course, was, is there hitting? So I think there's always been a way in which in hockey, obviously we've heard from many of the other presentations that it's a way in which boys become men, and it's an important social way that socialization happened for men. So women trouble that in a few different ways. So some of the questions I started asking, obviously, about the sport, you know, where were the heroic narratives? Why were they owned by men? Where had all the female heroes gone? I hadn't known about many of the women that I actually showed you pictures of. That's work by Linda Barrell. If anyone's interested, it's a book called Les Glorias, which is a fantastic book about the history of women's hockey. I wondered why there was no gender equity in Canadian university sport. I mean, in the U.S., Title IX had come in the 70s and was really responsible for creating a lot of equity in terms of funding in programs in the U.S. And in fact, the U.S. Still leads the way in many respects in terms of sporting culture and creating programs of excellence for their athletes. I wondered also a lot about what the value of the female game was. You know, I think that there was a way in which the violent instrumentality in the sport for men makes it seem as if that's the way that it should be played, whereas women don't play with hitting and fighting. And so it's a different game. And kind of learning about how to talk about that and what it is that I liked about it. Why is women's hockey always seen as lesser than? I mean, I just did an interview with Charlene Labonte where she was talking about how she still, to this day, has to defend the fact that she plays and to defend the sport. And basically, it usually takes someone coming to actually see her play or, you know, coming to actually watch the game before they are like, wow, you can really play. You can play hockey, you know? And why was women's hockey invisible? So actually, when I was growing up, there were no role models who played hockey. Not that I can remember anyway in my general consciousness. 1990 was the first World Championships, and in many ways, that's not that long ago. And the thing I remember most about this was I was 13, and I went to the provincial championships with my youth team, and I saw the jerseys laid out, the Team Canada jerseys, and they were all pink. And this was the first time that women's hockey, I believe, one of the first times it had been broadcast. I mean, early in the days of radio, many, many sports were talked about in the medium of radio by the CBC and so on. There was far more inclusion about different kinds of ways and different kinds of leagues and organizing and so on. And then, basically, with the onset of television, you know, became the focus on the NHL and almost a unifocus in a lot of ways on a more commercial brand of the sport. So this was the first time that women's hockey entered the public sphere in a real way. And, I mean, I was personally disappointed because, you know, I wasn't very interested in a pink jersey. But it was obviously a way to try to highlight the fact that these were women. So I think whenever women's hockey kind of enters the public sphere, it troubles a number of the ideas and notions we have around the game. So do women feminize the sport? Or does the sport masculinize them? These are all kind of questions that crop up. So obviously 1998 was the first Olympic sport. Most people never imagined that women's hockey would become an Olympic sport. I think it's probably a testament to how far the game has come that so many people were flabbergasted and excited by the comeback win that they just saw in Sochi. And I believe Carey Price recently mentioned that one way that they could get out of their slump would be to play like the Canadian women's team did in Sochi. So the times, they are changing. Obviously, when we talk about visibility, one of the key moments that pop out for me anyway was when Manon Raon played for the Tampa Bay Lightnings in what many consider was a publicity stunt. She played one game for them and I can't remember her record. I think she let in 3 goals. Anyway, it's always interesting to me that we talk about women's hockey when women play with men, and much less so when they play with each other. We obviously have Haley Wickenheiser, who went to go play in Europe, and that was to develop her own skills, because at the time, when she was really in her prime, there was no developing pro league. Shannon Zabados now plays in the PS, Western Pacific Hockey League. I don't know much about it, but she is earning a salary as a hockey player. And recently, Hillary Knight joined the Anaheim Ducks for a practice. And this is her on the ice with them. And I like this picture because, I mean, Hillary Knight is probably one of the biggest women who play in the sense of she's a strong, incredibly talented power forward. But she's still quite minute when you see her next to this gentleman who I don't know who he is, but anyway. And I like the image because the way I like to think about the sport is that, you know, women have different bodies and so we play a different game. And there are a lot of ways in which female athletes in female sport have been diminished over time because maybe they aren't as strong or necessarily as fast or as dominant or as rough. But in a way, doesn't having a different body create a different kind of game? And it doesn't diminish anything from athletic capabilities or strengths. And I really see the parallel with women's tennis, actually, because people didn't really take women's tennis seriously until it was played on the same surfaces and the prize money was the same. And then they kind of went, oh, women play a great, great tennis. It's a fantastic to watch a volley sport, and you know they have incredible rallies, and the power serve is boring. I see a lot of parallels there. So that was a quote from Carey Price. This image is always one that I really like. There's something about female athletes that's very humble. Marie-Philippe Poulin scored the winning goal in both Sochi and at Vancouver, and I don't know that there's a better story than that in many respects. She's an incredibly humble person. She's been playing at Boston University. And this year, she will be graduating. So as a GM in hockey, I'm certainly looking to her and to bring her back here to Montreal. And, you know, I think there's no athlete in a way that is in a position to do more for the sport and to promote the game than her. And that's really a lot of the reasons why I've been implicated in developing a pro league for women. So I don't know what time we're at because I don't have a...
Well, we can move on to questions if you want.
Well, I mean...
Or we have more time. It's up to you.
Yeah, I was just going to present a little bit about the CWHL, which is the work that I've been doing now. Yeah. I mean, I think...
No, we have time.
Yeah? Okay, perfect. So how many people are aware of the CW or have been to a Montreal Stars game? Okay, a few here and there. Well, the league itself was formed in 2008. It came out of the demise of the NWHL, which was an owner-based league. Obviously, as you saw from the pictures in the 60s, semi-pro and professional women's hockey isn't a new thing, so it's kind of interesting to see that it has this long history. Obviously, the players featured are world-class athletes, and there's no higher caliber of the game being played today. Basically, the league gathers the top players in North America. So those that compete and train for the national teams, for example, are playing in the league. We had, I think, 25 of our players were at the Sochi Games on various teams. 8 of them were from Montreal. We have 5 teams, Boston, Toronto, Brampton, Calgary, 24-game season. And what's interesting about the project is that I think from the ground up we're trying to build a pro league together. So it's very much a project about belonging. Obviously, it's gone in fits and starts, and it's not easy to develop a pro league from scratch. It requires a lot of money to run teams and to build leagues. But our basic model is actually not-for-profit, and it's a revenue-sharing business. So when there's money that comes in from sponsorship or from revenues, it goes directly back to everyone else. So it's kind of It's just a basic breakdown of the budget and to look at it in the context of the economics of today. So that's still where we're at in terms of basic dollar figures. Obviously, in the past couple of years, the CW has gone a long way in terms of gaining visibility, partly through some historic partnerships with NHL clubs. The Molson family, for example, have always been invested in women's hockey throughout the past century, but there have never been club-to-club partnerships of this nature. So these are very big developments in the women's game. We also have a four-year broadcast deal with Sportsnet. As I've mentioned, broadcasting for women's hockey and female games in general is not something that happens often. The WNBA is many years ahead of women's hockey. In general, hockey tends to be a very conservative sport, as many of you might know. And so it's been much harder to develop a pro league for women in hockey. We do have live streaming also of our games. And this year we had the first CWHL All-Star game, which was held at the Air Canada Center. And we actually had 7,000 people in attendance. They rebranded the entire facility. And for me, it was a really interesting moment because we had a lot of the women staff who work for the MLSC organization put on the event. And they had never actually put on a female professional event. They'd only ever worked on the Maple Leafs or the Raptors. So it was really exciting for them. And the other part that was really great was that the arena had no idea what to do with all the strollers. So they had parking issues with their strollers. And, you know, just being at that game and experiencing hockey with a totally new audience was a really kind of fascinating moment for me, and especially in terms of what I want and hope for the game, which is that it really becomes far more accessible to more people. I think with our price point, it's $15 a game, and the audiences we're hoping to attract, it's to make the game more accessible in general. And being at that game was fantastic. I mean, there were a lot of families, there were a lot of women, and the atmosphere was totally different. And I think it sort of says something about what's possible in the future. This year we also introduced prize money. The league does not pay players yet. Obviously that's what we're hoping to do, but we do need to increase revenues and attendance in order to do that. And so prize money is actually given out to the winning team of the President's Trophy for the season and also for the Clarkson Cup, which is our championship. So in other words, it's their group incentives, their team incentives. This is the Montreal Stars. We've won 3 cups over the years. We obviously signed an agreement recently with the Montreal Canadiens. It's a very exciting partnership that has taken a couple of years to put together and to negotiate and also to talk through with them. They're very keen, obviously, in helping grow the grassroots game. In Quebec, a lot of people don't know that the female grassroots game is woefully underfunded and quite ignored. Actually, we have 6,000 girls who play versus Ontario, who have between 50 and 60,000. So there are a lot of reasons for that, and it'd be another discussion. But there's a lot of work to do in order to open the game to young girls and to make it more affordable and accessible. So here was the All-Star game. There's kind of a... And that was a shot of the Air Canada Center. I like this photo because I think what we're doing in women's hockey is, you know, we're talking about a liberation process, and there are just so many ways in which the women who play in this league, they're working full-time jobs, they're just very passionate about the game. They love playing hockey, and it doesn't matter to them if they're working full-time, they're still going to train, they're still going to be competing. And then they also have a lot of respect for one another. And it's a collective project. There is no club, for example, in Montreal here without the league, and there's no league without the clubs. So I think that it's an interesting model for the sport and also a new way of doing things. This is our first sold-out game at our home arena, Étienne Desmarteaux, which is a very exciting day for me because I think what I'd like to do with the game in general and what we all want on the club is to share our passion for the game and what we do with a wider audience and to make that something. So that's kind of overview. It was less presenty, but yeah.
That was great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So thank you very much again, and we'll open up the floor to questions. Si des gens de questions. Go ahead.
I'm just curious, since hockey in North America has been much more popular than the association football, you have a situation in which the U.S. women football team and the Canadian are among the two, well, the top five in the world. Mm-hmm. And so you would expect that in hockey, each, whether it's like cross or not, you know, it's certainly much more popular.
Yeah, I mean, I think it ties back to the historical. I mean, there have been different presentations today that have touched on the ways in which the sport has formed masculinity, specifically in Canada. I used to do some research around this stuff, so I'm farther away from it now. But it has been an incredibly traditional and conservative sport. And it's been very difficult for women to break into it, whether that's because it is partly a very physical and aggressive sport is probably a good question for us to ask, and whether or not I think people are very attracted to the violent aspects of it. I am not particularly, but many people are. So I think that over the years, it hasn't been something that has been open to women. And it's also meant that the institutions and the organizations around the sport are also a bit more closed. I mean, I think back to 1996 or being here, I never thought once about the fact that I could be a GM in sport. And there aren't really women who are GMs in sport. So part of what we want to do with the league and what we're trying to do, and it's a process even within ourselves, is to figure out how to do things. And so the partnership with the Canadians is interesting because this is an organization that has 100 years of experience, right? But I think we bring something, too, to this partnership. And I'm excited about exploring what that might be. And, you know, there's the players on our team are incredible ambassadors for the sport. They're really intelligent women, and they all have 2 degrees. And they're working real jobs, and they have a real sense of the world and their place in it. And so, you know, once they have access to the kind of media machine that is the Habs, and once we see, you know, Charlene Labonte out with Carey Price doing the good work that they do in the community and so on, I think we're going to start to see some sea shifts in how people imagine hockey.
Question there. You right there. Yes? Yes.
I don't think I would be aware of it otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could tie back how women's hockey rules differ. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of, as not a hockey player myself, but there is no aggressive aspect in the same way that checking has to be done in a more subtle way. Mm-hmm. And just kind of tying that back to how men's hockey is sort of seen as the default. It's not really talked about as men's hockey and the consciousness of maybe consciousness of hockey and women's hockey, unfortunately, I think, still.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this idea of different bodies and different games, I think, is critical to the way I think about the sport. But I like the way that you worded it, which is to say that there are subtleties in the physicality of the female game. And I think that's a good way of describing it. There is no hitting and fighting in women's hockey, but it is physical. You can take someone into the boards. You can also... So there's checking in a sense, but no open ice hits, for example. So it's much more like the international game. And what that does is open up the game to a lot of speed, a lot of finesse, a lot of great plays. The women who play are, as I said already, incredibly intelligent. So there's a lot of strategy that you see playing out on the ice, a lot of back and forth flow. And it's a kind of brand of hockey, if we want to call it a brand of hockey. It's a kind of hockey that I really like to watch as a spectator. And you mentioned the Clarkson Cup. It's a beautiful trophy. Drank out of it, which is very fun. And I would like to bring it back to Montreal. It's a beautiful trophy that was actually created by the former Governor General, Adrienne Clarkson. She created this trophy for the top female team in North America to vie for. It actually happened during the 2007 NHL lockout. She suggested when she was Governor General that since the men weren't playing, why couldn't the women compete for the Stanley Cup? And there was such outrage and backlash against this preposterous idea that she said, well, then I'll make my own trophy. And so she had the trophy forged out of silver. It's made by Inuit artists. It has partly her coat of arms, I guess, on one side, and then a goddess of Inuit culture on the flip side. So it's almost like a mermaid. And this is the trophy that that we compete for now. So I don't know if that answered everything, but I do think that the big challenge is to actually get people to come to games or to showcase the sport, because once people do see it, they really love it. And, you know, everyone who comes to our games is really like, wow, I never knew this existed. And the catch-22 is, well, so far we haven't had the financing and the marketing dollars to actually reach people, so we're kind of stuck in this loop of invisibility.
Will?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, we live in a country, a world where the police forces and the military, which are guardians of nationalism and so on, were integrated long before hockey. Mm-hmm. I mean, why is that?
Take your time with the answer.
I mean, the university programs have, on their own, started to put more financing in women's hockey in general. There's different structure here. I wouldn't be the one to be able to tell you what it is. Title IX is really interesting because policy clearly turns into equity in many respects. And although, you know, there are big critiques of NCAA also, so we can go many different directions with that. But it has, in the U.S., created programs because men's and women's teams have to spend the same amount on their sports programs. It means that most of the women coming up through hockey now are experiencing million-dollar programs. So in other words, they are competing as elite athletes with all of the training and facilities that they need to be elite athletes. And then what happens is they come out of university and it's like, meow. No one cares, no one's watching, and so this is the project that we're working on. Well, how do we create the league for them so that when they're done their university career, they can continue participating in the sport? That didn't answer your question, though.
Good question there, yeah. Go ahead.
Towards the front, Glenn. Appreciation of athletic performance shouldn't be based on gender. But speaking realistically, why aren't more women supporting women?
I think it's a very good question. I think from what I've seen, because I've organized mixed leagues, beginner leagues for adults, and I see how hockey operates as it's a collective thing that you do with people, and it's something that you share with them, and it's networks and businesses that form, and it's all of these kinds of connections that happen because hockey, you know, you're getting dressed for like an hour before, you're going for beers after. And so I think you're right that we need to think of the ways in which how we start to invite women to more games, and also women with influence to invest in some of these leagues, as you know, men have done forever with their enterprises. But that said, I think there's another more interesting question in your question, which is about ways of looking and how women look at one another, and how what is considered worth looking at as a spectacle. And that gets into a lot of deep questions about whether or not we care about women's enterprise, and when they collaborate together, what that looks like, and whether we're interested in looking at it. And, you know, this ties into the history of television and all kinds of things, but largely our audience is female, and it's an important part of our audience, so we want to inspire women and young girls.
So I'd really like to thank Ms. Hewings for a great presentation, and